Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast, Chris Graham and Jeff Fife, and we're going to talk some UVA basketball that we've literally never talked before. UVA is going to a Final Four, Jeff, and all we can say is, wow, we've actually seen it. We were much younger the last time we saw it, but now we're able to say UVA basketball in the Final Four.
Yeah, I think I was in middle school last time we could make those statements. I think there's a lot of UVA fans up late at night and still celebrating, and here I am sitting out here with probably my third celebratory cigar and just still shaking my head at what I've witnessed. I want to talk to you, Chris, a little bit about the play that got us into overtime and then go backwards into the beginning of the game and how it all started, your observation thoughts. And look, take us to the Jerome play. It looked like he had about 7 or 8 seconds outside of the three-point line, and he had the big 7'3" kid on him. And boy, I thought he could have drained the three right there. He just hesitated long enough, and Painter had him smartly fouled. Now Jerome's on the line. In the post-game conference, Jerome says they didn't quite intentionally miss that second free throw, but he did it really well. And then take us from there when the ball bounced off and what you saw.
Well, and I'm reading the transcript, too, from Ty. He said, there's so much going through my mind, I didn't really miss it on purpose. I short-armed, and he really short-armed that well. If that's not intentional, it did work out perfectly. And, you know, it's interesting. On a night when Virginia gets 25 points from Kyle Guy, 24 from Ty Jerome, the most important play of the UVA season, and maybe now in UVA basketball history, is made by Kihei Clark. Yes, we remember the Diakite, and we will remember that Mamani Diakite makes the shot that sends the game to overtime. We'll talk about his presence of mind in a second. But Clark, I mean, that ball was bounding back in the backcourt forever, it seemed like. And there were only 5.7 seconds left when Jerome missed the second free throw. And so when that ball got tipped back there, and I think Jack Salt's the guy who kind of corralled it and tipped it back there. That's one good thing Jack's good at, is corralling rebounds, tipping them back. He did that a few times in the second half. And so that ball goes all the way in the backcourt, though. You know, I saw one writer from The Athletic tweet after the game, I guess maybe actually during the part between the end of regulation and the overtime. What a presence of mind for Kihei Clark not to just throw up a half-court heave, because basically he threw that pass from half-court with about a second and a half left. And then, you know, then the presence of mind of Diakite catching that pass to just quickly shoot it. I mean, he barely let it touch his hands before he let it go. And then it goes in the net. I mean, it's just amazing. And of course, the referees will look at the replay to make sure, but it was well out of his hands before the buzzer went off, before the light went off. And so, so for a guy in Clark, he did not score until 1.5 seconds ago in the overtime. He made the two free throws that clinched it, sent Virginia, you know, convinced it, the world that Virginia's going to the Final Four. But on a night when he played 24 minutes, couldn't stop Carson Edwards. Nobody could stop Carson Edwards. I don't think that an entire military armada could stop Carson Edwards tonight. But on a night when Clark, who's out there for defense, didn't score, couldn't stop, you know, the guy who scored 42 points, he did have 5 assists, including that one. He made the most important play of UVA season. And then Diakite, who I haven't seen, I don't even know if they name MVPs of regionals anymore, but if they did, in my opinion, it's Diakite, not just because he made that shot. In the regional, 4 games, he averaged 13.0 points, 9.0 rebounds. He shot 68.6% from the floor, and then he made that shot. And apologies to Barry Parkhill, a guy we've both talked to in the past. Apologies to Rick Carlisle, who made a shot to send Virginia to the last Final Four in 1984. That one right there, that one that sent this game to overtime, is the biggest basketball shot made in Virginia basketball history.
Yeah, T.A. got, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, T.A. get this type of minutes all throughout the season. Well, in the ACC play, he's going to be able to manage your team as a true freshman. It's a tough ACC field. And he proves that it right on that one lift cross-court pass. Even a slight look off and finds Diakite in a perfect set of timing. Yeah, I didn't know whether he's called a timeout there, if they even had timeouts, whether it's easier to just dribble up to half court and leave. But that kid, you know, the leadership right out of the gate and finding Diakite and seemed to be a level head, looking for options. He literally looked like a quarterback back there, needed to make a quick throw, and looked at 1, 2, found his third option. Fired the ball and it's magic, and now we're in overtime. It's pretty impressive. Now, starting at the beginning of the game, you know, and Purdue comes out hitting on fire. I think up until the 16-minute mark, both teams didn't miss a single shot, and yet Virginia was down 3 or 4 purely because they were putting up threes. And in the first start of that game, you know, what are your thoughts in that first 4 to 8 minutes of the game as Purdue is just hitting everything?
Well, my initial thoughts were very wrong, as it turns out, because I'm tweeting during the game and live blogging on the Augusta Free Press website and saying there's no way this Edwards kid keeps making these crazy shots. I mean, they were contested shots. I think of – and it wasn't even him. There was a three-pointer. I think it was a Klein three with about 13:45 to go. I'm looking at the play-by-play, so I'm not that much of a savant to just know exactly when it was. I've got the play-by-play in front of me. But there was a Klein three with 13:45 to go. That was the open one. That was off of an offensive rebound. He got a pass out, and he made the shot. The others were all contested, and they were – it's not like, you know, there was a game earlier this year, maybe it was the first half of the Louisville game at Louisville, where Louisville had a few open looks. And so when they went 10 for 14 in that first half from three, you know, okay, you got to clean that up because they're getting some open looks here. These weren't open looks. Even early on, Purdue started 7 of 10 from 3. They were contested shots. They had hands in the face. Edward was running off screens and throwing it up towards the rim, and they were going in. And so I'm thinking, Ed, this isn't going to continue. They're going to wear down because this is just a bunch of crap. They're just throwing stuff at the rim, and it's going in, and they're not running any semblance of offense. This will be fool's gold. You know, you'll really pay the piper when it comes down to it. And actually, I mean, at the end of the first half, I'm thinking, man, I'm a genius because in the last 8 minutes or so of the first half, 8:14, Edwards made a three with 8:14 to go to put Purdue up 25-16. They only made two shots of their last, let's see, two of their last 13 to finish out the first half, and they go from being up 10 at one point to up 1. So, yeah, my genius was saying he won't continue to make these shots. Yeah, he didn't continue to make them. He made them from further out in the second half. We'll talk about that, I guess, next.
Yeah, and Kyle Guy turns that ankle right before the end of the first half. And you wonder, you've got to have Kyle help it. You've got to have him back on fire. And he comes out in the second half. And it's three right out of the gate, which, you know, lets you know immediately we're about to have a heavyweight battle. We're just going to witness an amazing game. It's like the first time I sat down in the movie theater and watched Pulp Fiction. You knew you were about to see something special. And with this, you knew it was just going to be an unbelievable game throughout the course. And Kyle finishing with 25, 10 rebounds. And Virginia overall out-rebounding the Boilermakers, I think 39-31 or somewhere in that category. No one bigger than the Jack Salt SWAT out into half court. What was the impact, even as Edwards, and how did the team survive a performance like Edwards and still advance?
Well, I'll go back to Guy. You talk about the ankle sprain, and it's a weird thing. Jeff, for our listeners out there, Jeff and I both play. I mean, we think we're pretty competitive at pickup basketball, and we're both in our late 40s, so we're as competitive as you can be in our late 40s. And I actually had this weird thought when Kyle got hurt. You know, and whatever value I've got when I play pickup basketball as a three-point shooter. And, you know, he had been, and I did the numbers after the game, obviously. He was 1 for 6 when he got hurt at the end of the first half. He went down with 2 minutes to go. He actually got inserted back in the lineup for the last play of the first half. Didn't end up factoring in that play. But so he's 1 for 6 in the first half. That left him going into halftime. He was 8 of 44 shooting in a 2019 NCAA tournament. But I actually had this weird thought. You know what? Something's off. I mean, it's not off in warm-ups. He's making all the shots then because otherwise he'd correct it. So maybe something, the fact that he's got this ankle injury, maybe that will like make him think a little bit more about his mechanics when he's out there. And he might, you know, actually, it might actually be a good thing. In a weird way, a good thing that he sprained his ankle, because it'll actually make him kind of readjust in his mind how he approaches. Now, that said, he makes his first 4 actually from 3 to start the second half. He's just bonkers all of a sudden. And so that's part of the answer for answering Carson Edwards. Virginia defensively came out and tried to put DeAndre Hunter, the ACC's Defensive Player of the Year. We know he's going to be the 4th or 5th pick in the NBA draft this June. He's a good offensive player. He's even a better defensive player. So, hey, we've got the ultimate solution here. We'll put DeAndre on him. Edwards is 6'2", DeAndre is 6'7". He can guard guards. That'll be fine. First 4 minutes of second half, Edwards, I don't even know if he shot the ball in the first 4 minutes of second half. And then he decides, you know what, because that's when Virginia made a big run. They were down one and a half time. They went up as much as eight in the second half. And Edwards just says, I'm just going to shoot it from 30 feet and see what happens. And he made three in a row. And that reignited him in the second half. So the answer was, let's put DeAndre Hunter. And then once that got trumped, you had to feel like if you're a Virginia fan out there, we just kind of played our trump card. We just played which that's what we can do. If DeAndre can't stop this guy, nobody can stop this guy. And so then the answer became, let's just outscore them. And that's not, you know, for the people out there who don't watch Virginia regularly, even those who do, you don't think Virginia can outscore a team who's as hot as Purdue was, as Edwards was. But that had to be the solution, and for a while it worked.
Yeah, and when you had Ty Jerome also putting up 24 points, hitting some very clutch threes, a lot of answers. We needed to answer Edwards when he was hitting those threes and show that, yeah, you can hit that shot. And in the back of my brain, I'm thinking the same thing you were in the first half. He played 45 minutes 2 days ago. Yeah. He's going to peter out. And I think the peter out happened in that overtime. Yes. He just wasn't quite as effective. Talk about the final play when they're down five, they're down three, it's 5.7 seconds, and you could see Painter on the television broadcast drawing up a play. And I don't know why you wouldn't just run Edwards straight up the middle and give him a shot, but it felt like to me that QA pushed him towards the out of bounds line to the point where he didn't have any other choice but to make that pass and end up making a bad one. I think QA quietly making that brilliant pass TJ to get us into overtime, and then playing just the best defense anybody done on Edwards all day, sort of forcing him into a point where he had to get rid of the ball.
Yeah, nobody gets to listen to me do analysis. I do a lot of broadcast analysis for other sports, for other venues and that kind of thing. But I was giving my best analysis, you know, to the home audience of one, my wife Crystal, during that timeout. And you know, I'm talking out loud about, okay, so what does Tony do here? You know, what we saw Matt Painter do at the end of regulation was he played the percentages. Hey, Virginia's down three. I'm not going to let him shoot a game-tying three. I'll foul a guy with, you know, 5.7 seconds left, and they'll have to make free throws. They'll have to do something, and they'll have to get a rebound and get a buzzer beater, which is what happened. But the percentages are, that's the smart play. You know, you don't let them shoot a three. You don't let them have a chance to tie it. You make them have something magical like that, and odds are that doesn't work. So I actually said out loud too, okay, that's what almost every other coach does, but Tony Bennett doesn't do that. I've never seen Tony do that. And so, but that said, you know, and I just wonder if there was anybody on Purdue's staff who would be telling, hey, we've analyzed Tony and he doesn't do that. So the ball's inbounded, and what the play Painter drew up was, yeah, he's got the ball in the hands of Edwards. And then the play was drawn up to go Edwards going up court, passing to Klein, the other three-point threat on the floor. He was only 2 of 5 tonight, but I think he was 6 of 7 in the second half in the win over Tennessee 2 nights ago. So the idea, hey, we're going to throw the pass to Klein, and that'll draw Virginia's defenders to Klein because it'll look like we're going to him sort of as a decoy for Edwards. And you know, then they'll put their attention on him, and it was going to be sort of a give and go. And then a kind of a pass back, maybe like the Bryce Drew play from tournaments 15 years ago or whatever it was when he played for Valparaiso. So at first when I saw the play without kind of seeing that Edwards was trailing, I'm screaming at the TV, that guy should be fired. He's got a guy who can hit from Pluto, and he passed the ball to somebody else. What are you doing? But then you see the replay, and you kind of see what they were trying to do there. But I think, you know, when you see the replay also, you see that Kihei, yes, Jeff, you put it well. He at the half court line, literally at the half court line, he got just enough pressure over there to force that bad pass. And I think maybe, I mean, I'd wonder, and I haven't read the transcript of Purdue's postgame yet to see what maybe was going through Edwards' head, but I wonder if he thought, they're trying to foul me. Because at that point, he's already eaten up 2.5 seconds of the last 5.7 seconds. It was around 3 seconds ago when he threw the pass. And so if I don't throw this pass, they're going to foul me, and then I'm going to get a two-shot, and I'm going to have to do the same thing that Virginia did to tie this game back up. So that maybe forced the bad pass because he's trying to get the pass off before he gets fouled. I don't think Kihei was trying to foul him, though. I think Kihei was just trying to, just get a little bit of pressure on him, make him a little tougher. But I really wonder if Edwards was thinking, they're going to foul me here, and that maybe forced that quick pass, the bad pass. And, of course, that's the best bad pass I've ever seen.
It's a fascinating chess match, watching Painter put in two big men that don't normally play together, and then he started moving the ball and trying to get, as he was trying to sort of build a lead or stay competitive in the paint, and all of a sudden he started sending in south the big boys and started to have some effect. And then I noticed something very interesting, which I didn't hear any of the commentators talking about, and I'm sure I didn't hear anything to tell you about in the post game, but he sat Hunter down for the most critical minutes at the tail end of regulation. Hunter never came in that game the last 4 or 5 minutes, and didn't even come in until about the first minute in of the overtime, so he finally came off the bench. I'm not sure if he said something to Tony that got him agitated, or if Tony felt like he just wasn't the right play, but it was amazing to me, the most critical moment of those games, we didn't have Hunter on the floor. And then when he came in, this Hunter put his head down and driving to the basket. He got a layup, he got fouled, he also turned the ball over, but ultimately, Hunter seemed to be the focus of the overtime for us, getting some of our buckets and trying to establish a lead. Do you have any idea why Hunter would be playing during critical minutes?
He subbed out with 3:36 to go second half, didn't sub back in until 2:59 to go. I think it was effectiveness or lack thereof. His value, and he only scored 10 points in the game. He did have the eventual go-ahead basket, the driving layup with 26 seconds to go, but he only had 10 points, put up a couple ugly jump shots early, and then maybe sort of lost confidence. That's one thing we always talk about with DeAndre Hunter and his teammates in the locker rooms after games. So I was in Columbia last weekend, and his teammates get on him. He needs to be more assertive offensively, and he wasn't tonight either. But I think it was more of a defensive matchup thing. One thing I didn't even notice in the first half, and I noticed it then, and of course didn't notice it until after the game. Jack Salt had played 10 minutes total in the first three games, the first three NCAA tournament wins. He played 34 minutes tonight. And Tony, this season, and Zach Peerless had analyzed this for us a few weeks ago on Augusta Free Press. The lineup utilization this year for Tony was so interesting. He went four guard, what you would call four guard, about 80% of the time this year. So you very rarely saw two bigs on the floor. You very rarely saw a combination of Diakite Salt, Diakite Huff, who only played literally a cameo role 1 second at the end of the first half on that offensive play. But you didn't see two forwards on the floor very much. Well, tonight, Diakite played 42 minutes and Salt played 34 minutes. Because they played a lot together, because Purdue's big. And Salt, he had his quiet game. He had 5 points. He had a nice tip in. He had another basket. He made a free throw. He had 8 rebounds, a couple steals. But his defense, particularly on Harms, who only had 6. 7'3" guy, had 6 points in 37 minutes, only shot the ball 6 times, only had 3 rebounds. You talk, Jeff, about the UVA rebound advantage. Yes, this Purdue team, 24th nationally in average height. Love how KenPom.com gives you those kind of numbers, but not just the average height of the roster, but it's the average height of the guys on the floor and the minutes they play. So 24th nationally out of 353 teams in Virginia, who is 108th nationally in average height, and that's helped by the fact that Kia Clark is 5 foot whatever he is, and plays a lot of minutes. But Virginia out-rebounds Purdue, a much bigger team, 39-31. And it's because Salt was out there. Position defense, he actually got some great rebounds himself and then boxed out his guys. I think the Hunter situation was just we needed our best defense out there on the floor. And, except for Edwards continuing to go off in those last 3 minutes, including that banked-in three. And I want to get your thought, Jeff. I know what I was thinking when Edwards banked that three with 1:10 to go. What were you thinking? When at 1:10 left to go, and Edwards is making everything he throws towards the rim, and then he banks one in.
Yeah, I was thinking that Kihei gave the best defense that he could have on Clark. I thought Clark would have been very tired and setting up that shot and seeing it bank in. I thought to myself, if this is the one that knocks us out, that he finishes with an odd bang, and that's the one that's the difference. It's, you can accept it. But I also thought about in that same building, a bang that happened 2 years ago with DR 300 in Louisville, and said there's still an opportunity for us to make a little bit of magic in here. It's not over. In the post-game conference, Tony talked about ripping up his play card after that shot went off the glass. It came, and I thought that was interesting. I don't know how much he uses that play card, but Tony's response was fascinating to me as well. And I think ultimately, Virginia's got, and Kyle said it very well in the being interviewed on national CBS broadcast. You know, we made bad history last year, and we're planning on making great history this year. It was fun to see Kyle, because he's probably the center of that, that tragedy for Virginia fans and watching that. And the way he took him a little while to get past it, because he didn't have the greatest game against Gardner-Webb. He didn't have the greatest game against Oklahoma. And he wasn't having the greatest first half at all against a very tough Purdue team that was putting up shots left and right. But once he came up hot, you saw him the first half, he knew, this is going to be a lot of fun. And it was a lot of fun. And it means a lot to those kids. It means a lot to the program. It means a lot to the fans. But I don't think, listening to Kyle's comments, that the history is finished being written. I think this team was fully ready with the experience they've had from the UMBC loss to where they are with how they had to fight past a very game Gardner-Webb on the road, in essence, how they had to fight past a very game Bulletin on the road. Now they're going to get to go to a neutral field finally, with four very high-quality teams that they're going to have to get through.
Yeah, it's Kentucky-Auburn plays tomorrow. Duke-Michigan State playing for the right to play against Texas Tech, the surprise winner over Gonzaga earlier tonight. The history is not done. In part, it is. To me, and I don't think this is stretching it at all. To me, as a fan, I'll put the fan hat on now. There's still two more games to go. You got to win Saturday night. You got to win Monday night. You win those two games, and this is really the ultimate redemption story for a program. But hanging a Final Four banner has a lot to do with that too. And what Virginia's been able to do, it's not just that they're in the Final Four. It's not just that they're in the Final Four after what happened last year. It's that every single time this team has played on the road, and a lot of times when they played at home, there is a reporter, at least one, and usually lots, who say UMBC, and then they ask a question about that game. I mean, that's been the case, since the media day in October, 3 weeks before the season. It's been the case since the opening night of the season, early November. It's, again, every time they go on the road, the reporters for whatever hometown paper that they're playing against, they want to ask about UMBC. Whenever they showed up on visiting teams' courts, especially in the ACC, at Maryland in the Big Ten Challenge, there are people sitting in the front row, students representing the school they're playing, wearing UMBC jerseys and sweatshirts and hats, taunting them about UMBC everywhere they go. That's been brought up in their face. I was at the ACC tournament. There were people at the ACC tournament in games that didn't involve Virginia wearing UMBC. I feel bad for UMBC now. They've been selling, I don't know how much money they've made in the last year selling sweatshirts and jerseys and hats and everything else. That money's going to dry up now because that's gone now. But this team's had to play with that for a year. And I think the Final Four washes those sins away, if you want to call them sins. And, yes, two more wins. I mean, to me, this is already the ultimate redemption story. You come back from the low of those lows. That's the lowest. I mean, no one's ever lost to a 16. Then you're a one losing by 14 to a 16 9 days ago. And now they're in the Final Four. So, yeah, there's still more story to be written. I was talking with somebody tonight. There's an ESPN 30 for 30 just ready to be green-lighted as far as this goes. With two more wins, it will be.
If you're going to draft a script, redemption, I think you have to have Duke staring at you in the championship. I think you have to get through them after losing them twice. Your only two losses in the regular season. I think that's the team you want to sit across from to totally wash away all the demons. I do think there's a deep side that UVA fans can have, and the UVA team themselves get to that Final Four. I'd like to see a Duke team that has also survived in two very close games somehow manage to get through a very game, a veteran Michigan State team that's been there and knows what they're doing. And Lord knows that there's a Texas Tech looming. I think the country would hate to see Texas Tech, Virginia, because that could be another 52-48 game like we saw with Oregon. But whatever it is, I think Virginia controls their own destiny at this stage. And I think Minneapolis is going to be the crowning of an unbelievable redemption story and a great, hopefully a great closure to a wonderful career. And on our senior salt, who's got the most victories of any senior that's gone through the Virginia program, Bruce and DeAndre. And I keep thinking the way Ty is answering questions in the post game, that he's thinking that this is his last opportunity for these kids too. I hate to see that, but I think it's our time, and I'll be curious to see this Auburn Kentucky game and who comes out of that. And I think Virginia matches up well against both.
Yeah, well, and Auburn, of course, losing his leading scorer to that horrible ACL injury last night in the big win over UNC. Kentucky, they've got the one and done, but they've also got the senior transfer from Stanford, so they got some veteran leadership there too. And I don't want to overlook whoever the winner of that game is. Obviously, Saturday night next week, it's going to be a pitched battle to see who goes to the final game on Monday from that side of the bracket. But let me just say this. I'll propose an alternative redemption ending if you get to Monday night. Duke, obviously, the stars, the one and dones against the old guys. Virginia's got a little bit of history, just a teeny bit of history with Michigan State. And, you know what would happen if, and we don't know the schedule for games next week, at least I don't think we do yet. I haven't seen it yet, when Virginia plays first or second. But let's just say that, Virginia wins the first game and Virginia wins the first game. And Michigan State happens to upset Duke, and then they're playing in the second game. You know that, if Michigan State's playing Virginia, and there's going to be 2 days of reminders. It's going to be UMBC-like. Let's just put it this way. For the UVA fans listening to this podcast, you know it will be UMBC-like. Well, okay, great. This UVA team overcame UMBC and all this kind of stuff. But look who knocked them out of the Sweet 16 back in 2014, who knocked them out in the round of 32 back in 2015. This Virginia team can't beat Michigan State. So as fairy tale as you guys might think this is, you're going to run into the buzzsaw here. So either way you go, you've lost twice to Duke this season to that group, or you've never been able to beat Michigan State in an important game in basketball. So I think either way you go there, if it ends up being that way. Yes, the Virginia-Texas Tech game would be beautiful to our two sets of fans and then probably nobody else. But it's for a championship. So, and what amazes me, Jeff, is that we're still talking about UVA basketball. They're going to be playing in April. That's what your goal is when you start, and that's where we are.
That is where we are. Are you guys hitting the road to Minneapolis? What kind of coverage can you expect from Justin Free Press?
Well, the coverage you can
–
Zach Peerless, we're working to see if we can we'll apply for the credential for Zach. We'll see if Scott German can head up. This is my life. I've got baseball responsibilities next week, and so I'll still be anchoring the coverage from the home office in Virginia. We've got a lot to get you ready for. As soon as we know the opponent, we'll start previewing the game. The game's not till next Saturday, so we got a lot of time between now and next Saturday. But we'll put our heads together, Zach and Scott and I. And we're also working with the folks, JerryRatcliffe.com, longtime sports editor, UVA beat writer Jerry Ratcliffe, his son Scott. They're actually in Louisville now. I'm sure they're on their way to Minneapolis, so we'll coordinate some coverage with them as well, and then we'll get you. We're going to get you ready, and then we'll see if we can get Zach on a plane up to Minneapolis. And I actually looked at the weather forecast tonight. I let myself sneak a peek. You're not supposed to do this because that anybody who's a sports fan, you're superstitious, you believe in jinxes and all that kind of stuff. I looked at the weather forecast for Minneapolis next Saturday. 67 degrees in Minneapolis next Saturday. it's not going to be 30 and snowing, you know, April there. So, we're working to get all that together, but we'll have as much as you can imagine coverage of the UVA basketball team. I would imagine, Jeff, I don't know this for sure. This is uncharted territory. But UVA, when they head to the ACC tournament and then when they head out to an NCAA tournament, they'll have a media day there at JPJ. We've never covered a Final Four UVA team because it's been since 1984, and that was in the dark ages of media. I would imagine, though, that the folks at UVA might make some availability coming up perhaps Monday or Tuesday before they fly out to Minneapolis. So, but it's all new to us. It's all new. The whole writing base. It's new. It's new to all of us here. So all I can promise you is lots and lots and lots of UVA coverage.
And we will all be following the Nestor Press with their coverage of UVA's road to the Final Four and their redemption story. I am Jeff Reif with the AFP editor, Chris Graham. Somewhere in the very early Sunday morning, still celebrating a fantastic Virginia victory over a very game of Purdue Boilermakers team. And Virginia fans, rest well this week. Get ready to stretch those lungs out for some hollering, yelling, some cheering for your Hoos.